have to be able to portray soil health systems and conservation efforts, regenerative practices, however you want to frame it. It has to be an offensive tool that's an economically viable business decision.
Welcome to Dialed Up, a podcast where we take the biggest problems facing agriculture, dial the volume up, and explore what's being done to fix them. I'm your host, Eleni Paulson. The problem? Sustainable farming needs more support. In the last episode, we talked about government's role in supporting sustainable farming initiatives. We spoke primarily about crop insurance and how we might adjust crop insurance to better support sustainable farming initiatives. But we also recognize that crop insurance, protecting farmers against yield loss, is more of a defensive tool than an offensive one. And in the top of this episode, you heard grower Mitchell Hora reiterate the importance of sustainable farming as an offensive tool for growers. So, how can the government bolster our offensive efforts? I think the government can do this in a few different ways. We can bolster our ag infrastructure to provide more resources for farmers. We can be better stewards of educational information and expertise. And we could work to reduce some of the stigmas surrounding sustainable farming. Let's bring it back to Mitchell for a moment. Mitchell feels the government can help farmers gain access to resources and expertise.
Step number one is we got to help farmers to be able to quantify where they're at. I think that's step number one. Okay, so it's quantifying where you're at and establishing that initial baseline of where do you sit today. Now, what we're trying to bring to the table is the rest of the benchmark data set so that a farmer doesn't just get their data and they're like, okay, well, here's where I'm at today, but what does that mean? Am I good or bad or what? So through Topsoil, we're able to say, well, here's how you rank compared to other similar farms and then be able to dial in the data set even more robustly from there, especially as that critical mass of data is really needed or as is hit in different geographies. But step number one, help a farmer to be able to understand where they're at today. If we can quantify what their carbon footprint is, that's great. But even just be able to quantify the soil health metrics and establish, okay, where are we starting today? Then we help them to identify, okay, well, what are the opportunities to improve? And it's opportunities to improve profits. That's what it's about. They don't care about, okay, I want to improve my carbon and water quality, whatever, but I got to improve my bottom dollar. That's what it's about. I mean, and it's not just about money, but like, I mean, farmers, we're running businesses here. And if the farm goes broke, chasing after then this dollar or chasing after a credit or whatever, what's the point? It all falls apart if we don't ensure that the economics are going to be there, which means that farmer needs to have trusted advisors around them and they need to be able to work with other farmers. They need to be educated and they need somebody to hold their hand. And the current ag infrastructure that we have today is not equipped to be able to do that. Now they can learn and they can help to maybe be the initial touch point, but we got to have more educators behind the educators at massive scale. And data helps us do that. So initial data, identify opportunities to improve, hold their hand to work all the way through it, and then be able to quantify those outcomes. And I think that's a huge thing that is completely missed on this is it's not just about, okay, fill out the survey, check the boxes on what your management is. Okay, well now we're going to do this other thing and fill out the survey again. And like, if you check the box, then we're going to pay you. I just think that's so dumb. And every single program is being rolled out like that. But really what it is like, if you're going to help a farmer to adopt cover crop, there's so much innovation and such a wide, diverse impact that cover crop can make based on how it's managed and how creative that grower gets into being aggressive to allow that cover crop to actually do something for them. Now, at the beginning, they need to not be super aggressive. They need to be realistic and they need to be cautious. And that's why they need to have people that can help them to make the right decisions. And we're getting now, what's been really interesting to me on that is we're starting to get, at least in my like localized geography, we're starting to get to some of the later adopters of soil health, which is very interesting. So like later adopters of cover crops, we're already through the innovators and the early adopters, and now we're getting to the late adopters. One of the very few places in the country, probably in the world, that's happening. And it's just starting right now. Very, very interesting. But these guys need somebody to hold their hand. That's a big one. And being able to have some data to help them to make the right decisions. They want to see the stories. They want to see the case studies. they need to come out and they've got to have a little touch and feel to how is this supposed to work.
In addition to resources and expertise, we also have to make sustainable farming immediately actionable for farmers on a regional level. I spoke with Jolene Hadrich about this issue. With many farming subsidies, research programs, and sustainability goals, the funding and support is allocated on a national or a crop-based level. But how does that translate to access for each farmer on each of his or her fields? Let's hear more from Jolene.
Sustainable is going to be different depending on where a farm is located, because the Western model of dairy production is very different than dairy production you see in the Midwest or the East, where, you know, it rains more frequently, farms are a little bit smaller, they're able to raise their own feedstuffs, whereas in the Western part of the U.S., those dairy farms are significantly larger. And they may have a smaller land base, but they're purchasing that feed from another source. So maybe there's a local crop farmer that's raising that all for them, and then they're bringing it over. So those sustainability goals differ. And then there's also the other side of it, that a sustainability goal for a livestock producer is going to be different than a sustainability goal for a crop producer. And one of the things that I've been working on most recently is looking at the use of cover crops in the Midwest. And what cover crops are is, if you think about the stereotypical cornfield, you would have those rows of corn, but then planted in between those rows of corn would be a cover crop. So most common in the Minnesota is like rye grass. So that cover crop allows weed suppression, so you don't have a lot of weeds popping up, so you can decrease your use of, you know, pesticides or other herbicides for weed suppression, so that crop can grow. But then it also keeps that soil in place. So if there's like a bad wind event, or if we have a lot of rain, which has not been the case this year in Minnesota, but if you would have a lot of rain, those cover crops can pull that moisture down rather than having it just run down that row into a ditch. Jointly, when it's dry, that cover crop also, if you do get a small amount of rain, helps capture that moisture and hopefully distribute it with the root structure to the corn where it's needed.
Great. Thank you. That's really helpful. It's interesting sort of as we set the stage for support for sustainable agriculture, it's interesting to remind ourselves of those nuances, regional differences in how people farm and what that means for their definition of sustainability, and then what you're producing if you're raising livestock or if you're raising crops. Those things are so nuanced on the farmer's level and on the farm level, but can be, I would imagine, quite difficult for a national company or for a government organization that is responsible for a wide swath of people to define sustainability and then to help support specific actions that help meet sustainability goals.
That's exactly right. This is why the word sustainability has definitely been around for at least a decade. And it's why we've really struggled to pinpoint what that is exactly because of those nuances. And, you know, I know many companies and agricultural processors are looking at, you know, what's our overarching goal and how can we make this a portfolio approach where this sector of our business has this specific goal, this other sector has another goal, and the composite of all of those help us achieve that overarching goal. But it's really figuring out what those individual factors are. And I think the other thing that's really important for the greater audience to think about is, you know, we are great researchers and we're great scientists. And in a vacuum, we can say, this is what we need to do to decrease greenhouse gases or whatever that may be. But oftentimes, all of the parties that are part of implementing that specific, you know, practice are not always at the table. So while that practice may work perfectly in that closed environment, when we try to implement it at a farm level or at a corporate level, it doesn't work. And oftentimes it's like, oh, yeah, that specific process can be implemented year round. And we did in this closed environment, but we can't. And that's completely fine. That's research, but it's figuring out how those pieces come together. And it makes it a slow iterative process because this is a biological process. You can only raise one crop of corn a year. So, you know, you only have X amount of chances to test some of this stuff. So it does take time.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that it is quite interesting, especially, you know, just between research and implementation. When you research something in a closed environment, the intention is to gain a better understanding of what sustainability means from a certain perspective, or how we can better reach some larger sustainability goals. But at the end of the day, a lot of farmers are, yes, interested in making those changes, interested in, say, rebuilding soil structure from the example you listed, but they also want to make sure that they don't lose the farm in the process, risking too much. So understanding the research, understanding the implementation, and, you know, not only that it's a slow process with the biology of it, but it's also a slow process in making sure that farmers can keep themselves fed throughout the process too.
Yes, that's a really great point. All of these sustainability practices come at a financial cost. And if we know that those input costs are going to be higher for the producer, we have to make sure that the price that they're receiving for their product is also increasing. And oftentimes those things are not matching up, which also creates not necessarily hesitancy. It's, I would say, financial hesitancy. If farmers are already barely breaking even, to adopt another practice on top of that already low margin or negative margin is just a really tall order at different points in time during the production process.
Absolutely. Yeah, if I'm as a consumer living paycheck to paycheck, I'm not going to be spending a lot of money at the local farmers market. It's the same concept. If a farmer is already having a, you know, breaking even or having to be careful with finances, it's tough to make the leap towards something that is better in the long run, perhaps, but won't keep you around for the long run financially.
Correct.
You mentioned, we started talking a little bit about the financial barriers to adopting new practices. Could you speak a little bit more about the barriers to adopting these practices from an agribusiness standpoint?
Mm-hmm. So let's, I'm going to hop back to the cover crop example, because we just did a bunch of research on this. I had a wonderful graduate student who did this work. And what we did is we collected all of the sort of agricultural economic data for crop farms in Minnesota. And what we wanted to do is, often we hear cover crops described in the context of you plant them and then you have your livestock graze on it after you harvest the corn, and then it's an additional feedstuff. But the majority of southern Minnesota is crop-only operations with corn and soybeans. So we're like, how do they implement this without having a livestock source to come in and eat up that feed source? So they're really using it as some type of fertilizer. And what we sort of found, well, what we found with that research is that it costs about an extra, you know, $15 to $20 per acre to plant this cover crop. So that includes, you know, the cost of the seed, the time to plant it, and any additional like costs associated with that. Again, that's a ballpark. So the farmer has to figure out how they're going to find that extra $20 per acre. And if they're a 3,000 acre farm, odds are they're not going to do cover crops on all of their acreage. So what we did find was that it made sense for them to put cover crops on their marginal land, because once they put the cover crops on that marginal land, it allowed them to help rebuild that soil structure, and it could increase the yield of their crop on that marginal land to some of their more productive land. So from an agribusiness perspective, at least as we're starting to figure out what works and doesn't in different climates, the assumption that you have to use cover crops on 100% of your acreage probably is not realistic from a financial perspective. But if 15% of your land is soil that needs to be rebuilt or it needs to be regenerative, this is a good way to do it with the cover crop. So it was $20 an acre. We knew that was a cost, but then you could maybe adjust your fertilizer, whatever you needed to. What we thought was really interesting is that many of the locations that were testing this also had county level cost share programs. And those cost share programs ranged from just covering the seed expense for the cover crops to, you know, a blanket, here's $25 an acre to, you know, do cover crops. So what we found is that, you know, a cost share is probably needed for at least 1 to 3 years for a portion of the farmer's land so they can figure out what works best in their specific scenario. Again, it's not a one-size-fits-all strategy, and we all like to do that, right? We're like, plant this specific thing in this specific location. And if you think about it, when you like buy a packet of like, you know, like let's say green bean seeds that you're going to buy to plant your garden at home, that packet on the back has that like map of the US and there's those different colors and it tells you this is when you should plant certain things. We sort of need to do the same thing with cover crops, right? But at a state level as well as a national level, because in Minnesota, if you dice the state, sort of going east and west, so you're like you're slicing a vertical pie, if that makes sense, we have very different soil structures in the northern part of the state versus the southern. And to have a universal cover crop rule for the state is probably not going to work. So we would need to like make, you know, that seed packet recommendation for the state when we're talking about cover crops. But yeah, our sort of recommendation was it seemed like $20 an acre allowed the farmer to cover the general cover crop seed mix and figure out what works for them. The other caveat is it takes about 3 to 5 years to see the benefits. You will potentially see decreased yields at the beginning of this endeavor, but then as you build out over time, again, we use simulation models. We didn't do this, you know, like we, there are some things we have to simulate, but we were able to see those benefits over time.
Sure, that makes sense. I appreciate what you've said about marginal land too. And I imagine that that's marginally producing land. So the land that's a little bit iffy in terms of production, I can see how that would give farmers a good testing ground or a good place to start without risking that high producing land and without expanding the boundaries beyond what may end up being appropriate in 3 to 5 years. So you have this very clear defined area that you're going to test. You know that it's not going to be as risky as testing more productive land, and perhaps it's more comfortable to jump into the long haul of say a cover crop test if you know that you have very specific boundaries where you're testing that.
That's exactly right. You are able to see those random outcomes that happen due to weather events and then adjust and then try it again the next year. And then once you figure out what works best for you, then you can start applying it to other portions of your land that could potentially further increase yields as well on that more productive soil.
Right. Absolutely. My next question is about widespread adoption of sustainable agriculture, and I'm laughing at myself for this because you've just said that it has to be so regionalized, even split into different regions within states, because the soil is so different from state to state, even just in that cover crop example. And I'm sure with raising livestock, it's much different as well. And there are several other aspects to consider with that. So I would imagine that perhaps a widespread adoption of sustainable agriculture, and I say that with air quotes, would be something that you mentioned earlier, having a portfolio of goals for different regions, making sure that those goals ladder up to an overarching sustainability initiative or goal. And perhaps that would be for a specific facet of government regulation.
Exactly. I always tell people that the most successful farmers that I work with do two very important things. Number one, they know what their break-even cost is. So they know what they need to make in order to make $0. And then they know what they need to make above that to make positive profit. But they're also nimble and proactive. So they are looking at their portfolio of their farming operation. And they recognize that one year, one crop may not make them money, but there are three other crops that potentially are, and that it's cyclical, right? Like there are weather events that happen where there may be an insect that attacks your soybeans, but your corn is fine, or vice versa, or there's some type of animal disease that is out and about because of the weather conditions. And how do you handle that? That is something that I think would allow us to achieve sustainability at a quicker pace, but it would also decrease a lot of the apprehension that I feel like a lot of farmers are facing, because often you hear a goal that's imposed at a national level and you're like, there's no way. Like, I think, you know, electric vehicles are a great example in Minnesota, where we have at least 2 to 3 weeks that are like negative 20 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's like, yeah, that battery isn't going to survive that. That car will work probably 10 months out of the year, but there's probably 1 to 2 months of days, so 60 days over the course of the year, where it's just not going to hold its charge because it's too cold. So it's like, what do you do in that scenario? You still have advantages or tax advantages to purchasing that electric vehicle, but you also have to recognize that it's just not going to work all the time. And oftentimes farmers just get scared, or apprehensive, I shouldn't say scared, because you just, there's a lot of uncertainty. And once that rule is imposed, you need to figure out how to make it work. And if you can, then you have to have the decision of, I have to quit my job, and my job is being a farmer, and I've been doing this for, you know, 25 years, and now I have to retool my skill set, because these rules sometimes just, I can't impose it or figure out how to make them work on my farm. So there are a few avenues that this can go. So first, you know, regulations are created because we've clearly identified there's a problem in something, and we need to fix it. And that's why the regulations created. So that, I think, is something that we have to continue doing. But it sort of comes back to the way in which we are fixing whatever that problem is. We have to look a little bit closer to what is the financial cost of fixing that, and who is going to incur those costs. Is it going to be incurred across the entire, you know, like supply chain? So from the farmer to the consumer, or is it going to be incurred by one group? And, you know, again, I am going to, you know, give some examples about what I've heard from farmers. And oftentimes it feels like when these conversations come up, the cost is supposed to be 100% incurred by the farmer. And that gets scary, right? Because it's like, yes, we know that there's this problem, but sometimes this problem isn't necessarily happening at the farm gate. Sometimes it's maybe happening at the processing level, or, you know, we are using semi-trucks to haul this produce. You know, there are many things along the supply chain that are creating the need for some of these regulations. So, you know, I mentioned earlier that, you know, cost shares are a great way to figure out how to implement some of these practices at a farm level and get a true feel as to what these costs actually are. So we might encourage, you know, local counties or state levels to create these cost share programs. But then we get that data back and say, oh, that cost share was for $20, but we're learning that it only costs the farmer $15. So maybe we decrease that cost share to $15, and then that $5 can be reallocated at a different level. Again, I'm talking about it from the farm level, but, you know, processors are facing very similar decisions. You know, the supply chain throughout the system, you know, we are struggling right now to find anybody to drive a semi-truck to haul products from point A to point B. So there are many different places where these things can happen. I think it's just having that checks and balances. From my experience, farmers would like to be paid a fair price for their products. They don't necessarily enjoy getting government subsidies, but at the same time, they know that where the production process is right now and with market clearing conditions, they're operating at a loss. So having that subsidy on crop insurance to, you know, cover their crop in the event that there is a weather event that they lose everything, you know, is beneficial. So I was a little hesitant when you asked that question because it's a loaded question with a lot of different avenues to answer it.
Yeah, that's a great point. That helps me better understand how governments really are involved, or government organizations are really involved in regulating and facilitating some transition to more sustainable farming practices. It's considered often that crop insurance subsidies, specific allocated funds, are going to support farmers just wholesale almost. You know, we give you the money, it helps even out your balance sheet. You sell, you know, your product for this much, you receive this much, and in the end, it all breaks even. Mm-hmm. But there is a lot to be considered between farm and consumer that the government also, you know, can and should play a role in. If we are going to regulate how food is produced, if the end product is going to be regulated, then there should be some easing up of processes along the entire supply chain. Mm-hmm. I'm sure if there's a benefit to reducing greenhouse gas and carbon emissions, then we are also considering how those things are emitted in the transportation process, in the processing process. So it's important to consider that across all levels. That's a great point.
As you can see, there are many, many different opportunities for the government to get involved in sustainable farming practices. If we can find a way to subsidize sustainable food across the entire supply chain in a way that's region-specific, actionable, and flexible for farmers, we may have a shot at something truly supportive. The government. It's nuanced, it's specific, and it can come with some limiting regulations. How can we, consumers, corporations, and the general public, play our part in supporting sustainable farming? That's next time on Dialed Up. Thanks for listening.